Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to our 2 Men in the Bible broadcast. This is William Bell and our co-host, Don Preston. Don, how are you doing today?
I am well, William, and you?
I'm doing very well. I tell you, I had to jump through a few hoops to get here, but I'm here. We're still working on some things here, slow computers and...
Hello.
Hey, we got here in much faster time than we did last week, so we're making improvements, significant improvements. Well, Don, we had a very good discussion on last week. We talked a little bit more about the tabernacle from the perspective of raising up the temple of Jesus' body. So what direction did you want to pursue today?
You're the host.
Well, I thought
maybe... I'm just along for the ride, dude. You
know? No, you're the co-host. I thought after giving you a couple of weeks to kind of relax, get back into it after the debate, you'd be fired up and ready to go. But, you know,
first of all, let me interrupt you here, William.
Sure.
As I was telling you earlier in the day, let me make an announcement here. For all those who are listening, for all of those who will download this, next year's Preacher's Pilgrim Weekend, the theme for next year is going to be the Tabernacle of God is with Man. It is, as those who have been listening to this series know very well, and we've just touched the very hem of the garment, pardon me, this is such a marvelously wonderful theme. It is rich, it is full, it's exciting, and by the way, it's very, very relevant. And William Bell will be one of the speakers, and William was telling me he's already got his lessons prepared for next year.
They'll definitely need some tweaking, I'm sure, along the way. So there'll be plenty to do between here and there. I'm going to get a chat room open so that those who may be joining us can communicate with us via the chat room, and I'll try to monitor that while Don is deciding on what he's going to talk about today.
Well, another announcement. Let me make another announcement that everyone on my mailing list, those who have been visiting my websites, are aware of this. And, of course, I know William is aware of it. But what is, to me, just an incredibly exciting and, I think, important announcement is that I've been invited to present a paper October the 12th in Dallas, Texas, at the Criswell Bible College. The theme of this seminar is Perspectives on the Millennium. Now, what's so exciting about this, aside from the obvious excitement of being invited to speak on a lectureship, is the fact that some of the leading evangelical scholars in the world today, I'm talking some of the top guys, will be there presenting the respective views of the millennium. Greg Beale, who will be presenting a paper on the amillennial view of the millennium. Kenneth Gentry will be there presenting the postmillennial view of the millennium. Then there will be various representatives. For instance, Craig Blomberg will be presenting the view of historic premillennialism. Craig Blazing will be presenting progressive dispensationalism. Wayne House, I believe it is, will be presenting the dispensational view of the millennium. And I've forgotten, to be honest about it, and I apologize, but there will be another speaker to present the post-tribulational view of the millennium. So anyone who is familiar with the current status of evangelical Christianity and the top spokesmen, the top scholars in their respective fields, recognize these names immediately. Now, for a preterist to be invited to present the view, the preterist fulfilled view of the millennium on this forum is really, I think, quite unprecedented. Anyone familiar with Criswell Bible College knows that it was established by a dispensational minister. For them to open up their college to the respective views of the millennium, first of all, speaks volumes, and certainly for them to invite me to present the preterist view of the millennium is an unprecedented thing. William, I think it speaks volumes of how far the preterist movement has come over the last few years, especially, in being recognized as a legitimate theological paradigm. So needless to say, this is incredibly, incredibly exciting. It's very, very humbling for me to be invited to present this. I solicit the prayers of all of the preterist community on my behalf that I will be able to present the preterist view succinctly, effectively, concisely, and powerfully in order to communicate that truly and indeed the preterist or fulfilled view of the millennium is in fact viable. You know, it's interesting to me, Andrew Perriman, who is a world-class scholar, was kind enough to write a review, a preview of my book, We Shall Meet Him in the Air, The Wedding of the King of Kings. That preview is on the back of that book now. And Andrew Perriman made the comment after reading that manuscript that it has become increasingly evident that the preterist view, what many of us prefer to call covenant eschatology, but the preterist view is a very serious theological view and, quote, deserves a place at the table, unquote, in serious discussions of eschatology. And as I mentioned a moment ago, William, you and I have seen tremendous, tremendous changes in the preterist movement since we very first got involved. And you in the mid to late 80s, me in the late 80s for sure, until the present moment. For someone in the preterist community to be invited to speak at a forum like this would have been unthinkable 20 years ago. It would have been unthinkable almost 10 years ago. And now the invitation has come, and we're just so absolutely incredibly thrilled about it.
Yeah, I think that's very exciting news. I think it, you know, every day that these encroachments are made upon the territory, you know, the eschatological turf, so to speak, we'll find or should be finding less and less of the of those who want to say that this is just sort of a peripheral viewpoint that is on the outskirts of theological discussion. What we're finding with these kind of events and these kind of opportunities is that people are recognizing that it is a force to be reckoned with. It is something that, as you have just stated, merits the discussion of reasonably minded people and serious Bible students, and that it has, you know, some arguments that are just absolutely powerful when they're laid beside the other views that are out there. The very fact that we have all of these different points of view that you've just gone through, you know, in terms of the amillennial view, the postmillennial view, the dispensational view, you know, pre-trib and all of those post-trib, all of those examples are examples that people can't get the view right, that they haven't gotten it right, that there are some problems with it. I think we just lost Don, so Don, you know, just go ahead and call back in, and so we will we'll get you back on. But you know, as I was saying, this is very evident of the fact that there are some problems that are out there, that people are beginning to recognize those problems, that others are beginning to demand answers, and all this is going to do is just give more exposure to the view of preterism. So that once it's in the light, you know, I mean, think in terms of what could happen in, you know, a few years. Instead of having maybe three views or four views, you know, there's going to be a book that at least includes the preterist view among these scholars, so that people really have an opportunity to evaluate it in a way that's going to be, you know, not so one-sided as it has been in time past, where people are just standing taking shots at it. But, you know, they'll have to weigh the merit of the arguments. And as we've seen in the attempts in, you know, various books that have been written, you know, the two major ones that came out of, you know, recent in an attempt to refute preterism have been woefully short of accomplishing that goal.
Boy, that's an understatement. And I think what you're saying is absolutely correct. Now, pardon me. I've been very disappointed in the fact that Criswell Bible College, and I'm certainly not trying to impugn anyone, but for some reason they've chosen this will not be filmed. Now, each man will be given an audio of the entire lectureship. I certainly intend to have my digital recorder to record my presentation, and I'll make that available just as soon as possible. I'm going to ask for permission to tape or to record. Still use the word tape. shows you where I came from. But I'm certainly going to ask permission to be able to digitally record each one of the men as well, because certainly this is truly a momentous occasion. And it's something, I mean, a lot of people would love to be able to hear each of these representatives, each man doing their best to present their case, critiquing the other cases, critiquing the other views. It's not a debate, but nonetheless, each man, I'm sure, I know the style of Craig Blomberg, for instance. I know the style of Craig Blazing. I know the style of Greg Beale. I know the style of Kenneth Gentry. In their presentations, they will be making critiques of the views. And of course, let me be very candid. I'm the first speaker on the dais that day. I really fully expect to have a great big bullseye on me for the entire seminar. I am most clearly, I'm the outsider of all of the outsiders at this conference. So I don't expect anything otherwise. Another thing that I'm really, really disappointed in is the fact that although there will be a roundtable discussion, after all of the presentations have been given, pardon me, this roundtable discussion will only last 30 minutes. And, you know, William, my own wife says I can't even say hello in 30 minutes.
Yeah, I'm just thinking, you know, when they get the first question out, by the time someone even gets their thought process in place, that half of that's going to be gone.
I mean, there's no question about it. By the time, if in case they do this, by the time they reintroduce everybody.
Right.
Okay. Well, here's Dr. Blazing, and here's Dr. Beale, and here's Dr. Gentry, and blah, blah, blah. Good grief. It takes 10 minutes. And I'm pretty sure, I may be wrong on this, but I'm pretty sure the first questions are going to be directed at Don K. Preston's. To try to trip me up, and that's fine. If I'm given the opportunity to have the questions addressed at me first and that I'm allowed to speak, that's just fine with me.
Mm-hmm.
But it's going to be very, very interesting to see how this ultra-short open forum roundtable discussion goes, being limited to 30 minutes.
Yeah, well, it's like I said, that is going to be just a momentous event, and I think it's, you know, it's historic in terms of the movement, and once again, it kind of places a damper over the mouths of those who claim that, you know, there's nothing happening with the full preterist view. This definitely shows that something is happening with it.
Well, I've said very often, William, you and I have talked, have these conversations very, very often. We hear all the time. We read on blogs. We hear on radio interviews. We hear, or rather, we see it written. Oh, the preterists, you know, there's maybe 1,000 of them in the world, or, you know, it's just a fringe movement, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, I remember a couple of years ago, and you may remember this or not, but one very prominent member in the Churches of Christ out of Memphis, I challenged him to a debate. And he said, people are no more interested in hearing about the preterist view of eschatology than they are hearing about how many angels can dance on the head of a pin.
Oh,
well,
yeah.
What was so ironic about that is that just the previous month, I had had a radio debate with Dr. David Engelsma from Grand Rapids, Michigan, on John Anderson's radio program.
Mm-hmm.
And the network that we were on only had 200 and 25,000 portals for people to log on to listen to the debate on the internet. Every single portal was jam-packed full. They had people calling in to the station, as they later reported, by the hundreds, saying, why can't we get on? And so here was a member of the Churches of Christ, so completely out of touch with what's going on in the evangelical world and the interest in eschatology and the interest in preterism, saying, nobody is interested in hearing about covenant eschatology, so I'm not even going to debate it. Well, only a month before, an absolute minimum of 250,000 people were tuned in, and literally hundreds, perhaps thousands, trying to get in to listen to the debate. So it just shows you how out of touch some people really are. It almost makes you think, William, that some of the people who make these claims, oh, preterism is not growing, they're just a few in number, blah, 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 it almost makes you think that they're expressing their own personal wishful thinking instead of having any cognizance, any awareness, or true awareness of what is honestly going on in the world.
Yeah, I think that's a true assessment, that they don't want anything to be going on with it, and so they sort of, as you would say, they prophesy or position their own viewpoints there, only to find out that they continue to be, refuted by what actually happens. I remember many times, similar statements that were made, why should we even talk about this? And yet they would have an entire lectureship on on AD 70 or something related to it in an attempt to refute it, but would do all they could to make sure that no one who espoused it had any say in the matter. So
I remember one anecdote here. This is true, and I have a copy of the tape. At the lectureship, prominent lectureship in the Churches of Christ some years ago, during the Q&A session, like I said, I have this on tape, someone from the audience asked the panel, how do you deal with this AD 70 doctrine? And the speaker said to the audience, ignore it. Whatever you do, do not talk about this topic. Do not study it with people. Do not talk about it with people, because just as sure as you're due, you're going to cause trouble in your congregation, because just as sure as you start studying the topic, some people are going to start believing it. And off camera or off mic, they thought the speakers are speaking among themselves going, man, I wish they wouldn't have raised that question.
Yeah.
So there's no question that there's a great deal of paranoia, if you wish to use that term. There's just outright fear. They know very good and well that when people start studying on their own, then they start seeing the validity of the issue. And you know, William, I hear from so many people, perhaps this is a segue into what we can discuss the rest of the program. I hear from so many dispensationalists who are becoming increasingly disenchanted. I have received an email from a gentleman in the Phoenix area just this week. He's 33 years old. He was raised in a dispensational world, but through his own study began to seriously question the dispensational view. And through his own studies, basically arrived at the view of covenant eschatology, did not realize there were other people out there, and got on the internet, began to search, and lo and behold, he found my websites and found some other websites and has been purchasing books. And the guy is absolutely, completely, and totally on fire right now and has begun to see the fallacy of the dispensational view, and was writing me, another former dispensationalist recently contacted me on Facebook, and again, he's a former dispensationalist, and he says, Don, how can we reach this dispensational world and, show them the fallacy and the danger of this view? Well, my response was basically, we just got to keep sharing. We just got to keep showing people the fallacy of that view in a kind, loving, firm, and exegetical manner. And that leads me to one of the key issues, William. You know as well as I do that in the dispensational world, the conversion of the Gentiles is viewed as the failure of God's promises to Israel. Jesus came to establish the kingdom. The Jews rejected that kingdom. Therefore, God withdrew the kingdom offer and turned instead to the Gentiles. And as Merrill Unger, one leading authority in the dispensational world, as simply one voice, he said, God's prophetic clock stopped ticking at the cross. Others take different points of time, but be that as it may, most of them say the 70-week countdown of Daniel chapter 9 stopped ticking in the first century, and God suspended Israel's prophetic plan. Now he has another plan for the church, so there are two hopes. There's one for Israel, one for the church, and Merrill Unger, along with Dwight Pentecost, John Wolverd, and other dispensationalists, take the position, or took the position, depending on whether or not they're alive or not, that we must by all means keep the kingdom plan of Israel separate and apart from the church and her promises and her plan. The church was absolutely, totally unforeseen, unprophesied, unpredicted in the Old Testament. And by the way, if anyone wants to doubt anything that I'm saying here, I can provide multitudinous quotes from Wahlberg, Pentecost, Unger, and all of the people that I'm alluding to here. There's no question whatsoever that they take the position that the church was not predicted, not foretold anywhere in the Old Testament. And again, what they see is that the Gentile mission, the calling of the Gentiles, was never a part of God's Old Covenant kingdom promise made to Old Covenant Israel. So, William, I think this raises a very, very important issue of how important it is for us to realize that the calling of the Gentiles was, from the very beginning of God's plan, a part of that plan, an intrinsic part of the plan, that God's redemptive plan was not supposed to be exclusively for Israel, isolated in Israel, exclusively belonging to Israel, that God, from the very beginning of creation, as it were, intended for all men, regardless of their ethnicity, to be included in his kingdom plan, and that God's promises to Old Covenant Israel from the very beginning included the calling of the pagan nations into the blessings of God's promises to Israel. I think that would be a really good thing for us to discuss, William. Perhaps there will be people listening to the program tonight, or perhaps those who will download the program at a later time, to realize how fundamental the calling of the pagans always was in God's scheme of redemption.
Yeah, well, it's so interesting, especially when you talk about the pre-Israel days, that, you know, God called Abraham while he was, you know, yet uncircumcised. And that's one of the main arguments that Paul makes, both in Romans, the fourth chapter, as well as Galatians, the third chapter, and of course many other passages in the Bible. But those are two very key ones that suggest, and well, not suggest, that emphatically state that God called them for the express purpose that he might be the heir of the world, and, you know, not only for those who were under the law, but also for those who were of the faith of Abraham while he was yet uncircumcised. I believe that's Romans 4.
Romans 8 and following, yeah.
Yeah, and so he says in Romans 4, I'll just start in verse 9, he says, does this blessedness then come upon the circumcised only? Well, there's a good question right there. That, you know, people should take note of and answer, and which, you know, the Bible answers if they would just read a little bit further. It says, or upon the uncircumcised also. Now, that would refer to those outside of Israel. He says, for we say that faith was accounted to Abraham for righteousness. How then was it accounted? While he was circumcised or uncircumcised? Not while circumcised, but while uncircumcised. And that is indicative of the fact that God had included or had intended to include those who were uncircumcised in his plan from the very beginning. Because let me just interject this statement from Galatians chapter 3 very quickly, and I'll come back to Romans. In these verses, the Bible says in Galatians 3, 7 and 8, therefore, knowing that only those who are of faith are sons of Abraham, and the scripture foreseeing that God would justify the Gentiles by faith, preach the gospel to Abraham beforehand, saying, in you all the nations shall be blessed. So, you know, when you put that together with Romans chapter 4, you just have an absolute powerful line of argumentation that, you know, is made by Paul, you know, divinely inspired to demonstrate that the calling of the Gentiles was not something that was an afterthought or represented a failure of God or anything of that sort. But they were a part of the plan from the beginning. It was just a matter of time before that came into play in terms of what the way God had it laid out. And so I'm just going to read down to about verse 14, and then I'll hand it back to you. So he says, and he received the sign of circumcision, a seal of the righteousness of the faith which he had while still uncircumcised, that he might be the father of all those who believe, though they are uncircumcised. Now, that couldn't be Israel. That couldn't be the Jews. He says that righteousness might be imputed to them also. And the word also is indicating something in addition to what is already the case. And so he says, and the father of circumcision to those who not only are of the circumcision, but the contrast, who also walk in the steps of the faith which our father Abraham had while still uncircumcised. For the premise that he would be the heir of the world was not to Abraham or to his seed through the law, but through the righteousness of faith. For if those who are of the law are heirs, faith is made void and the promise made of no effect.
You know, that's such an incredibly powerful text. But you know, William, there are those who say that the uncircumcised there is simply a reference to the 10 northern tribes of Israel who were still of the lineage of Abraham, but they just simply were uncircumcised. But that still becomes, that suggestion becomes an absolute denial of what Paul says, that Abraham is the father of those, not only of those who are circumcised, because of faith, by the way, but all of those who were uncircumcised. He doesn't limit the uncircumcision to a very, very limited ethnic group of people. It is any who were uncircumcised. By the way, there's such a fascinating thought to me here, William. Joshua chapter 24 makes it a point of saying, our father Abraham was a wandering Amorite. Wait a minute. Wait just a minute. Abraham was of the seed of the Amorites. Physical lineage, right?
There you go.
So the physical lineage of Israel, in reality, while you can obviously say that the children of Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, 12 sons of Israel, etc., are of the seed of Abraham, they are in fact of Amorite lineage.
Yeah, isn't it in Ezekiel where he says your father was an Amorite and your mother a Hittite?
I thought that was in Joshua chapter 24. Maybe I missed that. But
well,
but
I think
is,
it's in Ezekiel as well. But go ahead.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Probably in both texts. But again, the point being, here are your mother and father. They are not of a bloodline that is distinct from the, quote, Gentile, may I use that term, that are distinct from the Gentile nations. They are taken directly out of the Amorite and the Hittite blood lines. So it raises the question, William, what was the only thing that set Abraham apart from the bloodline of the Amorites and the bloodline of the Hittites through Sarai?
It was his faith.
Absolutely. Having nothing to do with blood.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So those who are saying that the only people that God really loves or cares about are of the blood of Abraham, the lineage of Abraham, are in effect refuting their own doctrine because they're absolutely ignoring that Abraham was an Amorite, Sarai was a Hittite, and all of Israel that descended from them were therefore of the Amorite and the Hittite bloodlines. But God did not distinguish upon bloodlines when he spoke of the salvation to come through Christ. The very passages that you alluded to discount completely and totally the bloodline and focus on faith and only faith. I mean, after all, let's face it, how can you focus on blood, the bloodline of Abraham, when in reality, as we've already pointed out, the bloodline of Abraham was purely Gentile? Is that a valid point or not?
Oh, that's definitely a valid question. I even like it. It's found in Ezekiel 16, verse
yes,
3.
Yes, yes, yes.
But let's note, Don, how it's positioned there. In verse 1, he says, "Again, the word of the Lord came to me, saying, Son of man, cause Jerusalem to know her abominations, and say, Thus says the Lord God to Jerusalem, your birth and your nativity are from the land of Canaan." Well, we know who the Canaanites were. Your father was an Amorite and your mother a Hittite. I mean, didn't Abraham purchase the cave of Machpelah from the sons of Heth?
Absolutely.
To bury Sarah. Okay, so that tells you very clearly what their bloodline was. And
absolutely.
Therefore, they couldn't object, or they can't claim that Abraham did not have the Amorite blood in his veins. But that wasn't
in other words, how could the Israelites, this may be another way of saying things, can the Israelites hate the nations when that's where they came from?
Exactly. That's like hating your mother and your father. And, you know,
that's right.
They really should honor them, to be honest.
Now, we can't discount the fact, obviously, that here is God called Abraham out of Amorites and Sarai out of the Hittites. And yes, God said he was going to destroy the Amorites because the sin of the Amorites would come to its fullness, Genesis chapter 15. None of that negates the fact of his heritage. None of it affects where he came from. Does not touch the irrefutable fact that that was his bloodline. The fact that he separated himself from that sin and immorality, once again, is the focus of God's appreciation and God's rewarding of him, but it gets back to his faith being the key, not his blood.
That's right. And then think about it. Even after God established Israel, even though they had Abraham's blood, it did not prevent their being disciplined, punished, sent to exile because they had the blood in them and eventually destroyed.
That's exactly right. Well, William, share with us a few of the Old Testament passages. I think I'm thinking of Deuteronomy 32. how significant it is that here at this extremely early time in Israel's history, when Israel has just barely become a nation, they've come out of Egyptian bondage, they've wandered in the wilderness, and now they're standing in front of Moses, and Moses gives his song, and he sets it within a context of many generations to come. It's clearly not for his day, but it's for Israel's last days. Deuteronomy 32:19-21, and Ezekiel 32:29-31. So here we have a prophecy of Israel's last days, and we have a prophecy concerning the Gentiles. Why don't you share that with us?
Okay, so in verse 19 of Deuteronomy 32,
yes,
and particularly, Moses points out when he starts this song in the latter verses of chapter 31. He says to them in verse 29, "For I know that after my death you will become utterly corrupt and turn aside from the way which I've commanded you, and evil will befall you in the latter days, because you will do evil in the sight of the Lord to provoke him through the work of your hands." Now, in the actual chapter of 32, there are several statements, particularly verses 19 through 21 and 22, and then even some more later on in the chapter. But he says, starting in verse 19, and he's talking about Israel after they have forgotten God, after many generations would turn their backs on God and rebel against him. He says, "And when the Lord saw it, he spurned them because of the provocation of his sons and his daughters. And he said, I will hide my face from them. I will see what their end will be, for they are a perverse generation." And those statements are repeated by Christ in the Gospels. It's repeated by Peter on the day of Pentecost, or you could say all of the apostles. And it's repeated by Paul in the book of Philippians, where they use this exact language from Deuteronomy 32 and call their generation the perverse generation, the corrupt generation. And so he says, children in whom is no faith, they have provoked me to jealousy by what is not God. They have moved me to anger by their foolish idols. But I will provoke them to jealousy by those who are not a nation. I will move them to anger by a foolish nation, for fire is kindled in my anger and shall burn to the lowest hell. It shall consume the earth with her increase and set on fire the foundation of the mountains. So here we have this statement saying that God was going to provoke them to jealousy by what was not God and move them to anger or through those who were not a nation. And of course, he's alluding to the Gentiles. If you look even further, I don't know how far you want me to go with these references.
Just go ahead and develop it.
Okay. So in these references, you can see the quotes of them in the New Testament as well. Paul quotes directly from Deuteronomy in talking about the times of Israel's end, and also the inclusion of the Gentiles in Romans chapter 10, for example, as he lays this out. But let's look at another couple of texts here in this particular chapter. He says in verse 43, he says, "Rejoice, O Gentiles, with his people, for he will avenge the blood of his servants." And of course, you can find some of that in Revelation as well. "And render vengeance to his adversaries, and he will provide atonement to his people." So if we turn to Romans, you'll see precisely the use of this language. Let's go ahead and take a look there and note how he uses the language in from Deuteronomy to point out that the very time in which he's writing, in that very time which the New Testament calls the last days, we have these statements that are being made concerning Israel. And so He says in verse 19, Romans 10 and verse 19, but I say, did Israel not know? First, Moses said, I will provoke you to jealousy by those who are not a nation. I will move you to anger by a foolish nation. That is a direct quote from Deuteronomy that is being applied to people in Paul's day who were rejecting the gospel, to those who had, among Israel, who had refused to accept the gospel. And he's quoting out of Deuteronomy saying that the time that Moses had spoken about was the time in which they were currently living at the time. It was being played out right in front of their eyes. Go ahead.
And I have to interject right here. Let's go back to something that I mentioned at the very outset, and that's the dispensational paradigm. And that is that according to the dispensational view, Jesus came to offer the kingdom. Israel rejected it. So God withdrew the kingdom offer. Now, Thomas Eyes says that from the first century and the suspension of the kingdom offer, that no prophecies concerning Israel, no Old Testament prophecies concerning Israel have been or are being fulfilled. Now, I want the listeners to catch the power of what the dispensational world is saying. From the cross onward, no Old Testament promises and prophecies made to or about Old Covenant Israel are supposed to be being fulfilled. So for Paul to say that what was happening in the preaching of the gospel to Israel in his day was the fulfillment of Deuteronomy 32 is incredibly devastating to the dispensational paradigm, and here's why. Israel's last days supposedly do not begin counting again in the dispensational view until the rapture. Because, you see, God's currently dealing with the church, and the church and Israel are separate. Their promises and their prophecies are never combined, we are told. Okay, so God is not, supposedly, at the time Paul wrote, dealing with Israel or fulfilling any of Israel's prophecies, because Israel's prophecies at this point supposedly belong strictly, solely, and exclusively to the 70th week of Daniel 9, which does not resume counting until the rapture. And yet, William, we have Paul saying that the prophecy of Deuteronomy 32, which is the prophecy of what would happen in Israel's last days, was being fulfilled because they were provoking the Lord to jealousy. He was, in turn, provoking them to jealousy by the calling of the Gentiles, all in fulfillment, once again, of Deuteronomy 32. Now, William, if Deuteronomy 32 was being fulfilled in the preaching of the gospel to the Jews after the cross and in Paul's ministry, that means that Israel's last days prophecies were being fulfilled in the first century and during Paul's personal ministry. But if Israel's last days were being fulfilled in the first century and in Paul's ministry, then the dispensational idea that the 70th week of Daniel had been suspended, postponed, is absolutely, totally falsified.
Oh, absolutely. And this becomes a powerful argument in showing that here is Moses prophesying the 70 weeks of Daniel. I mean, he's telling you right here that he wants to see what their end will be. And he's talking about the terminal generation. So we're looking at that time frame. And as you say, there is no question in terms of whether or not this was a prophecy foretold. And we see Israel and the Gentiles included. There's no accident here. This is all a part of what had been stated by Moses.
You know, it's interesting to me, a scholar by the name of Nanos, David Nanos, wrote a book some years ago entitled The Mystery of Romans. Now, I certainly don't agree with everything that Nanos wrote in his book, but nonetheless, one of the key kernel thoughts that he brought out so eloquently, so powerfully, and so effectively, and so irrefutably in the book was that Paul's personal ministry to the Gentiles was not, as, for instance, the dispensational world says, a sign of the failure of God's promises to Israel. It was, in fact, an integral part of God's faithfulness of God to Israel, because it was always, always God's plan to call the Gentiles. And, you know, William, you and I were raised in the amillennial world, and while the amillennialists decry any comparison between amillennialism and dispensationalism, in truth and in fact, there are many, many, many parallels between the two, because after all, what do amillennial preachers say all of the time? Well, Israel rejected the kingdom. Now, they say, they teach and believe that, yes, the church was prophesied and foretold in the Old Testament, but in the final analysis, Israel failed. And so God called the church. Again, they modify the dispensational view, but there is no question whatsoever that the dispensational view of the failure of Israel leading to the Gentile calling of the Gentiles and the establishment of the church is a similar view to the amillennial view that says, yes, indeed, Israel failed. Israel failed. And God established the church. Oh, yeah, that was in fulfillment of Old Testament prophecy, but it's still the failure of Israel. No, it wasn't. There's nothing about God's plan failed.
Yeah, and
go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, every time they raise the issue of God failing, and yet they place hope in future fulfillment of prophecies where they feel 100% certain that there can be no failure. And yet in all the ones that they've prophesied between that point and now, there have been failure, not on God's part, on their part, to project things according to the way they are written.
You know, what's interesting to me as well, William, to go back to the dispensational paradigm, Thomas Ice, John Walberg, Dwight Pentecost, and what have you, they all go to Matthew chapter 10, and they say that Matthew chapter 10 predicted not Jesus' generation, not the proclamation of the gospel to Israel in Jesus' generation, but in fact, Matthew chapter 10, according to the dispensational view of things, will only be fulfilled in the tribulation period after the rapture, when the 144,000, quote, super evangelists, unquote, from Revelation chapter 7, Revelation chapter 14, out of the 12 tribes of Israel, are sent to Israel to preach to her. And what will their message be? Oh, their message will be, repent, for the kingdom of heaven has drawn near. Well, that sounds kind of familiar, doesn't it? Well, as I challenged Thomas Ice in private correspondence some years ago, and I've challenged any number of dispensationalists to consider the following point. If, in fact, Jewish rejection of the kingdom offer in the first century led to the withdrawal of the kingdom offer, the postponement of the kingdom offer, and the delay of the kingdom offer so far for 2,000 years, then why won't the same rejection that we find in Matthew chapter 10 result in another similar postponement, another similar delay, another similar gap? Why do I say that? Well, because in Matthew chapter 10, as Jesus tells them to go and to preach the gospel to Israel, guess what it says? That you shall be hated for all men for my name's sake. They will bring you before kings and before councils. They shall persecute you. They shall chase you from city to city, but you will not have fled from persecution. From whom? The Sanhedrins. you will shall have not fled through all the cities of Israel until the Son of Man is come. So here's my point. Dispensationalists say the preaching of the gospel that the kingdom was near in the first century was rejected, therefore God withdrew the kingdom offer. We're told that Matthew chapter 10 is the preaching of the gospel, the kingdom of heaven is drawn near, in the tribulation period after the rapture, as the 144,000 go to Israel and proclaim the kingdom of heaven is drawn near. Oh, but wait, according to Matthew chapter 10, the message of the kingdom is rejected in Matthew chapter 10. So I ask the question again. If the rejection of the kingdom offer by Israel in the first century resulted in the postponement of the kingdom, why won't the rejection of the kingdom offer in Matthew chapter 10, i.e. during this so-called tribulation period after the rapture, why will it not result in postponement of the kingdom again? I think that's a valid question, don't you?
Oh, I think, yeah, I think it's a very valid question. And it just shows that there's no end to this kind of reasoning that places the failure on God rather than on the lack of discernment in understanding and believing what the actual statements are. Some of the statements are so clear and so emphatic that it's to me, it's hard to miss what they're saying. Like some of the ones we started off reading and some of the ones that we just covered in Deuteronomy, they are extremely clear, and you see the application of them in the New Testament by divinely inspired men saying this is what it is. And yet, people are confident to say that it's the failure of God. And
no, I think it's appropriate. I'm sorry to interrupt you there, William. But I think it's appropriate to introduce some comments here. I can't quote it verbatim, but in G.K. Beale's new book, it was brought out last year, A New Testament Biblical Theology, he has some really, really good comments about hermeneutic. I found it. I happen to have the book laying right here, as a matter of fact. But G.K. Beale says, is the New Testament merely making a comparison, or is it depicting the actual literal inaugurated fulfillment of the prophecies about the universal expansion of Israel's land promises? I would respond to that question with a presupposition that is supported by much exegesis on how other Old Testament prophetic passages are used in New Testament texts elsewhere. Should not those with a high view of Scripture begin with the assumption that the New Testament interprets the Old Testament contextually and with hermeneutical integrity? Accordingly, if an Old Testament passage quoted in the New Testament is a prophecy in its original context, would not a New Testament author also see it as prophecy? And would he not see it as beginning fulfillment if he identifies the prophecy with some reality in his own present time? And even if there is no fulfillment formula, would not the passage still be seen as fulfillment? Now, possibly, Beale says, a New Testament writer could use the Old Testament analogically, in other words, simply by comparison, but the weight of the prophetic context of the Old Testament passage tilts toward a notion of fulfillment if there is no clear evidence to the contrary in the New Testament context. If this is a correct hermeneutical approach, then the prophecies discussed in this chapter, in which he discusses the church is the end time Israel and the new creation, in which he sees Israel's failure and Israel's promises now given to the church, which is a misguided hermeneutic. But nonetheless, he sees Israel's promises somehow, some way, as already but not yet fulfilled in the New Testament. Now, I just simply want to say this about Beale's. His comments are really excellent in many ways. What he says is this. If the Old Testament made a prophecy, then if it's cited in the New Testament, then guess what? The New Testament writer is not saying it's not a prophecy. Secondly, the New Testament writer is citing the Old Testament prophecy not as unfulfilled, but as fulfilled or in the process of fulfillment. Thirdly, Beale is saying that the New Testament writers are the inspired interpreters of the Old Testament prophecies. Now, this is really interesting, William, and I know we're just about out of time here. Now, even though Beal does not use the term, the Hebrews had a term for the concept, or I should say there was a principle known in the first century. It's used in some of the rabbinic writers. It's certainly used in the Dead Sea community. And it's known as the Raz Peshar, and I don't know if I pronounced that correctly or not, R-A-Z-P-E-S-H-E-R, principle. And that's this. The Old Testament writers did not fully understand what it was that they were predicting. They did not understand the time or the nature of what it was they were predicting. Boy, that's precisely what Peter says in 1 Peter chapter 1, 10 to 12. But Peter emphatically says, Paul emphatically says, that while the Old Testament writers did not understand either the time or the nature of what it was they predicted, the New Testament writers, through the Spirit, were interpreting those Old Testament prophecies. Now, here's the critical point that Beal touches on and then turns around and denies. Beal says the New Testament writers are saying those prophecies are fulfilled. But, of course, Beal doesn't believe they're actually fulfilled. He believes they're yet unfulfilled, and I'll give a prime example. In this very book that I just read from, and again, this is G.K. Beal, a man for whom I have the utmost respect. By the way, he's on this forum in Dallas in October. Brand new book, a New Testament Biblical Theology. He talks about the Sabbath. And William, he says, the Old Testament Sabbath has been removed and has been replaced by the first day of the week, Christian Sabbath, as a foretaste and a foreshadowing of ultimate salvation. William, there's something horribly wrong here. The Old Covenant Sabbath was a type and a shadow of coming salvation. But in G.K. Beale's theology, the Old Testament type and shadow really only foreshadowed the Christian Sabbath, which is itself a type and foreshadowing. I didn't realize that shadows foreshadowed shadows.
Yeah, where's the image, right? Where's the real thing?
Where's the body?
Precisely.
So, I'll stop there. There's a lot more I could say, but anyway, I'll stop there.
All right. Well, you certainly have given a very good exposition and delineation of the view of Scripture as compared to the view of dispensationalism. And as we close today, we want to thank those who visit with us in the chat room. We always appreciate you being with us, and I hope that you've had an enlightened hour over this past few minutes that we've been together. Also, we wanted to just make this closing statement regarding, and we want to talk about some of the things Don mentioned. So remember his announcement that he made concerning Criswell Bible College, where he's going to appear there and present one view of the millennial perspectives. And so that's very, very important. He also announced for next year's Preterist Pilgrim Weekend that the topic is going to be the temple of God, or the tabernacle of God. Behold, the tabernacle of God is with men. So that's another significant announcement. And then we'd like to close on this statement. And one of the persons in the chat room suggested it by his comment. And since we were talking about, you know, the failure of man or the rejection of man, but here's a statement that Paul gives in inspiration. He says, "What if some did not believe? Will their unbelief make the faithfulness of God without effect?" And that goes along with the statement in the chat room that basically said God's actions are not dependent on men's actions or the lack thereof. And I think especially when he has decreed something to be, we should understand it. And that's even Revelation when Jesus said, "Let those who are righteous be righteous still, let those who are unrighteous be unrighteous still." And so neither of their actions were going to change the fact that he was going to come quickly and consummate all things that were written in the law and in the prophets. Ladies and gentlemen, it's been a pleasure being with you today. I'm William Bell, your co-host, along with Don Preston, co-host, and we have enjoyed this time with you. Don, any closing words from you?
No, just God bless and good night.
All right. God bless. Good night, everyone. We'll see you next week, and we'll be having some exciting news for you coming up very shortly.